Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Good morning. Welcome to Medicine on Call. I have one of my favorite people on today, Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And Dr. Singleton's been on the show several times, and every time she comes on, our discussion transcends, you know, the ordinary, and we talk about things that really matter. And we've had such an onslaught of laws that have been passed by Congress in the last 3 or 4 months that have just, you know, reconfigured medicine. And we've been distracted for many reasons and many things going on. But I wanted to come back to the centerpiece. And by having Dr. Singleton on, we can actually get rid of the politics and all the drama and just really talk about where medicine is going, how HR 2, how the Supreme Court decision on Obamacare really affects us. I don't care what party you belong to, if you're a man or woman, it really doesn't matter. I've said it before, I still mean it. We're all in the same boat. You know, it's a divide and conquer strategy that's been used to a T. It's actually starting to fall apart, in my opinion, where people are really starting to listen to themselves, and they're stopping the Pavlov response of, I'm black, I should think a certain way. I'm urban, I should think a certain way. I'm from the South, I should think a certain way. And before the show started, we were talking briefly about Donald Trump's candidacy. And whatever you think about him, at least we're now breaking out of that haze of political correctness where, I don't know about you, Dr. Singleton, when I was a kid, you know, it was the mantra of sticks and stones will break your bones, but words will never hurt you. I have never seen words used in such a manner. I mean, right now, there's a movement to stop the use of an illegal alien. And the movement is, oh, it's demeaning to humans. There's no such thing. Yes, there is. I mean, come on. People are coming over the border illegally. They are partaking of a system in whatever means they do it, whether that's committing crimes or taking social services. It affects everybody, and it affects them. I mean, I can't imagine, I know we're going off script for a quick second, but children coming over without parents, in a system without anybody to care for them, what happens when somebody who has nefarious intent takes control of that child? Who's going to speak for them? I know it's not child welfare services that does it. And when they become an adult and they're so angry and they're so bitter and they want to take revenge, and who wouldn't if you're in that situation? What do we do with them then? You know, everything has a consequence. It's not all about sweetness and light. And just because you're, you know, progressive and you think everybody's awesome and you should want to help everybody, it doesn't necessarily work out that way. There needs to be rules and regulations. Now, I'm not sure about your take in on that is, but I know that you live in California, and it's a lot of things afoot out there, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you mentioned the term alien. Jerry Brown just yesterday signed it into law that term was to be taken out of all laws. I mean,
what's the point?
It's so ridiculous. And, years ago, Dick Gregory, the black comedian, had this whole thing about, I really don't care what you call me, it's what you're thinking inside. And it's a very good riff. And of course, you know, it's the N word that he says, I don't care, you can call me this, you can call me that. And it was back in the Black Power day when, in fact, the word black came out, said, oh, you know, that's the good word to use. And he said, I don't care what you call me. If in your head when you're looking at me, you're still thinking the N-word, then that's what it is. And that's what's happened with political correctness. People are using the right word, but like Shakespeare said, a rose by any other name is still a rose.
Excellent point. And it seems to me it's backfiring and boomeranging. I know you've seen the piece in Seattle where Bernie Sanders is shouted down by Black Lives Matter activists, and the interesting chant, or what they said initially, was when people started booing them about Seattle, you know, this is, you've just proven the point that we believe that, you know, Seattle is a bastion of, what do they call it, white supremacist progressives.
Right.
What a comment. I've been saying this pretty much, not to that degree, but most of the time I'm thinking, you know, you're progressive. You think everybody's stupid. You think no one can handle their own business. Black people can't run their show. Women can't run their own show. You know what's best for everybody. So you're proselytizing on how that should roll out. I think that's completely racist and sexist. Finally, Black Lives Matter people are speaking out. And it's interesting that the Democrats are getting the heat from this. And O'Malley was kind of a weasel about it. Bernie Sanders just slinks off the stage. I wonder now if the Democrats will stop taking black people for granted. Because we've been a monolithic group for ages now, you know, 20, 30 years of continuous Democratic votes and taken for granted. I wonder if that'll start to fracture now.
I wonder, because you look at the cities that are falling apart, and when some of the so-called black leaders want to indict white racism and all this, you have to turn around and say, well, who's your mayor? Who's running the city? Baltimore is a perfect example. All the city fathers and mothers are black. So why is it white people's fault that things are falling apart? And it's so true of many of the other cities, Detroit and Oakland. We used to have a black mayor. We don't anymore. And but we had a black police chief, and the police department is still under federal control. So having black leaders, sadly, all that does is just put another power-hungry person in power. And they, I don't know if they forget what their mission was or whatever, but I think it's those basic paternalistic policies that ultimately make the city fall apart. When you take any drive and desire to better yourself, saying, oh, we'll take care of you, don't worry, little children, your city ultimately falls apart.
I mean, it comes down to the main, you're right, paternalistic mentality of, and that goes pervading the society right now, including medicine, where some central group or centralized position of power gets to decide and give their blessing to whatever they think, however they think the system should run. Social engineering springs to mind. That, to me, is a curse word. As soon as you start saying social engineering, that means personal rights, personal responsibility go out the window. Personal choice goes out the window because it's all about many outweighing the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. And it's the lowest common denominator. You know, you've got core curriculum, it's unbelievable. Medicine now is like a core curriculum mentality. It's not, it's by committee. You have these hospital, I'm sure you can tell us, hospital-based committees that decide what medications get used, what the protocol for treating a disease is, how long it should be before you get the patient better. And if you don't, you've become an outlier or a bad doctor. I mean, that's what's going on in medicine, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the outcomes of this hospital control is the small hospitals are disappearing because they can't afford to stay in the Medicare system. This whole readmission rule where the hospital will not get paid if the person is readmitted with the same problem within 30 days, I find one of the most appalling rules there is, because this puts really bizarrely all the control over the patient. Once the patient has left in the hands of the doctor or whoever controlled their discharge from the hospital, how can you control what people do when they set foot out of the hospital? You can't make a smoker not smoke. You can't make an obese person not eat. And a diabetic person not eat cookies and cake after you've tried to heal their wound, and they continue to do whatever they do, or they put it in water after you told them to keep it dry. How is that the doctor's fault? And you know, it's a way just to sort of punish the hospital, punish the doctor, have an excuse not to pay. And do you really think that doctors and hospitals on purpose discharge people so they'll have to come back in 30 days? And when people in a really callous way say, oh, well, that way they'll get more money. No, Medicare doesn't pay you enough to want a Medicare patient back, not to mention that, gee, we went into medicine to make people better, not to shuffle them in and out of the hospital for a few paltry dollars.
Exactly.
And it's sick.
It is, and it's degrading and devaluation of the physician that we're just there for the money now. And, you know, we're making these this hill of gold, taking care of patients. We're doing it because we love it. Certainly, it's not because you're making money, unless you're on the outside of the insurance industry, and you're making fee for service, and you're able to charge what the market would bear, like, you know, LASIK surgery or plastic surgery. Most physicians aren't doing that. And even if they are making that money, trust and believe, they're working their butts off for it, you know, doing, multiple cases per day, seeing 30, 40, 50 patients a day. That's what they're doing to make that money. And if you distill it, it's really little, very little based on per patient.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the things about being somebody who's in service, where you don't have a product that, while you're on vacation, that product is being sold by your employees, mm-hmm. so you continue to make a living. But every day you don't work, you don't generate any income. And, sometimes you think, oh my goodness, doctors really do need to take more vacations, but while they're on vacations, that office staff still has to be paid mm-hmm. by something. And that's just a fact of life. But like you say, people become doctors because you love doing what you're doing. And doctors certainly aren't great business people. And they're mostly busy just trying to take care of patients, trying to get patients to follow the orders that they gave them, and hopefully the patient will get better. But guess what? Not every patient gets better.
No.
And it's not always in control of the doctor. There's something called, well, it might just be time for that person to go, or that person's body has just been sick for so long, mm-hmm. it just can't recover this time. And that isn't necessarily up to the doctor.
Don't you find it kind of schizophrenic, the fact that the system expects physicians to be perfect? You know, every patient you see, you have to get better. And you're a magician, so you should get them better in a certain prescribed amount of time. Yet on the flip side, you're one of the most evil people on the earth, because you're charging for your services and you're making too much money for the sleight of hand that you're doing, getting somebody better. It can't be both ways. Either, you know, we get respected for being caregivers, and what's wrong with making money in this country? As long as you do it, you're doing, providing a service, you're providing something for value. What's wrong with getting paid for what you do? All of a sudden, you're supposed to just do it for free, actually pay someone for the privilege at this point, and love it. What is up with that, do you think?
It's a way to demonize, because even people who don't have money, of course they want money and would like to have a job where they got paid well. And most studies show that people don't hate people with money. All they do is think, gee, it'd be nice if I could do what they do so I could make some money. It's easy to demonize doctors for making money, because you're supposed to be this kind-hearted person who does this, that, or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess kind-hearted people don't charge. I'll never forget one time my billing service fellow had called me, and he said, oh, I had to tell you this one. He said one of the patients didn't want to pay their copay, which was really quite minimal, and said the excuse was, Dr. Singleton was so nice. How would I know if she charged me something? And Ray said he just told her, well, if she was so nice, you should want to pay her extra for being nice.
Isn't that interesting? On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to Medicine on Call. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. I think we're having a far-ranging discussion this morning with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. She's an anesthesiologist and also an academician, a lawyer, a doctor, and someone who's on the front line of healthcare policy, who actually understands what's going on in Congress, because to me it seems like a black hole lots of the time. Now, Dr. Singleton, in this segment, I want to tease out, you know, we are in the political season. A lot of, you know, especially Chris Christie, has been talking about reforming Medicare, Social Security, and, you know, this is the 50th anniversary of Medicare, isn't it?
And Medicaid.
And Medicaid, and something that I read up, especially on the AAPS website, AAPS online, people.org, people should go there and really learn stuff. I didn't know that Medicaid and Medicare and Social Security were not entitlements. I had no clue about that, because I was always thinking, you paid into the system, how can someone have the nerve to means test you after you work for, you know, 50 years and you've had that money taken from you? What gives someone the right to say, well, it's tough, you don't get it, you don't get it, or you're only going to get a portion of it because you were responsible? Turns out that it's not an entitlement, is it?
No, not at all. And it's very interesting, because the case had gone to court for people trying to define what Social Security really is. And people all this time have honestly believed, I put the money in, I'm supposed to get it out. Mm-hmm. Isn't that my so-called contract with the government? No, it's not. And the government can do whatever it wants with it. And it's really the world's biggest scam. And what's sad is, if you took the money and saved it yourself, you'd be much better off. But of course, then the pyramid scheme wouldn't work unless you have everybody throwing their money into the pot and the government hoping that you die before you have a chance to use it. And unfortunately, that's not happening now that people live so long.
That's true. And now they want to extend to make it longer before you're able to access your money or the money. And, you know, for those who don't know about this, there's a law, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1937 found in Helvering versus Davis that Social Security and by extension Medicare was constitutional only as a tax, not as insurance. Boy, doesn't that ring a bell about Obamacare? I guess they did have precedent.
All that, a tax.
Yeah. Well, so I guess I'm not so surprised that Justice Roberts, you know, declared that in the decision. So they had precedents for this. It wasn't like they just pulled it out of their hat. And I thought, hey, this is the most bizarre decision. But no, they actually could have looked back at this law and done the same thing. Well, maybe they did.
Well, he probably did.
Yeah.
And knew that was standing on solid ground. And it's pretty hard to argue the whole tax thing. Because, yeah, it is a tax.
And the same framework exists too, doesn't it? You have one segment of society paying for another.
Exactly. And there's no question, and I don't remember who had said it in one election, that Social Security was a Ponzi scheme. It is a Ponzi scheme. Do you know, well, one, when Social Security, the concept, was taken from Kaiser Wilhelm back in the 1800s, he had made up the concept of paying for old age.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking the 1800s. He picked the year 65, because in the 1800s, no one lived until 65.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew the system would work.
Right.
Then fast forward to the 1930s, when we started Social Security, that they used the same number 65, and yes, people were living longer than the 1800s, but still, not that many people lived beyond 65. So again, the system would work. And as people started to live longer, typical of Congress, no one addresses the issue of, we picked this age because nobody was alive to collect the money. So what are we going to do? Either change the system entirely, change the age, whatever. But it was as though it was never addressed. It was just ignored because, oh, well, it'll all work out. Well, guess what? Back in the 30s, there were 35 workers for each retired person. Now it is 3.
What? That's all?
That's all. So here we're talking about where are you going to get the money for that pot? And one thing, our birth rate has gone down so low, and I hesitate to even bring up the word birth, and we wonder why our birth rate's down. So we don't have as many people. And this is one of the arguments for immigration, that since Americans aren't having babies anymore, we pull in immigrants, and they will contribute to the Social Security system.
Mm. But they're using more social services than they are, you know, you have a bunch of children coming in who are not workers. They can't be. They're too young to do it. What are they adding to the system? We have to wait 20 years before they can add it to the system?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's one of those arguments that, as you just quickly analyzed, if you think about it logically, it doesn't make sense. But as we know, all of today's explanations are sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
And what one sentence that sounds good, and so no one analyzes it to say, wait a minute, that doesn't really make sense.
A lot of it doesn't.
So, yeah, good idea. Bring in some more people to pay for Social Security. But the net amount of money you get is probably very low once you subtract the years of social service payments of one type or another. And we're not a cruel country. Once you have the people here, you're not going to have them starve on the street. You're not going to deny them entrance to an emergency room, et cetera.
No. And you can't on top of that. But it's still the whole level of healthcare, the whole level of social services, because it's so overwhelmed, it's worse. I mean, you're paying more for nothing now. Thank goodness we don't have to live in a situation where you're on the government dole, but that's not a good thing anymore. It never was a good thing, but it's certainly not a good thing now. And, you know, we talked a little bit in the break about what happens when the patient leaves the hospital, how you really don't know what they do. Well, I wonder now, you know, you hear all these little coming advancements of healthcare, like taking that RFID chip pill that you can determine if the patient took their medication or not, and telemedicine and wearing bracelets for diabetics to find out what their blood sugar is. You wonder now if those things are coming online because it gives that extra extension of knowing what the patient is doing outside of it and having an EBT card or having so any kind of monies that you get from the government where they can electronically track what you buy, when you buy it, is that going to be the way that the grid comes down or locks into place? Yes, doctors won't know, but if you can't buy Coke or you can't buy a pack of cigarettes with your EBT card anymore, maybe that's how they're going to do this, or they're monitoring you electronically to see if you are eating sugar outside of your visit. Hey, it's possible, isn't it?
Well, it's totally possible. It's one of those things, when I'm listening to you, I think of various programs that people criticized, 20, 30 years ago, even more recently than that, and people say, oh, you're crazy. You're really wacko. The government would never do that. And lo and behold, when the truth comes out, everyone suddenly is shocked. Hearkening back to an article I wrote quite a while back called Government Can Be Harmful to Your Health, one of the things that at the time everybody thought was crazy, and then the truth came out 20, 25 years after it happened, the government actually had dumped a bacteria called serratia over five major American cities, including San Francisco. And this was at the time that I was a med student at UCSF. And we had patients that had this bacteria, and we couldn't figure out why they had it. And, you know, so they got treated, and that was that. And then someone had sued the government. I guess somehow they had gotten wind that the CIA and the Navy had dropped this bacteria over San Francisco. And again, everybody said, oh, come on, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Well, they didn't win in court because they couldn't prove that that's where they got the bacteria from. But the people didn't care because it brought the program to light. And then in the 1990s, the Navy came out and officially said, yes, we did this. Who would imagine that the government would purposefully drop bacteria over major cities? It sounds like something out of a movie, but it happened. It's documented.
And there's no apology for it either, is there?
No. It was necessary to test and see whether biological warfare would work or whatever, the excuse was. But so we have incidents where the government has put their own people at risk for their own purposes. So you really can't put anything past them. And it might be for a good reason, but that doesn't matter. You do not control people's lives that way.
No. And I know we're going to take a break, but I want to ask you about informed consent and the loss of that right when we come back. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwanted influence by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
The War State by Michael Swanson is a must-read for anyone interested in the critical 20 years after World War II, when the United States morphed from a constitutional republic to a global imperial superpower. Get The War State by Michael Swanson from Amazon.com today.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare. But for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Today we're speaking with Dr. Marilyn Singleton. And Dr. Singleton, you're in California. It seems to me now it's next to Seattle. I'm sorry, Washington State has become the epicenter for some bizarre stuff. So, sorry. What I want to ask you about is the exemption for religious and personal choice against vaccination. That's gone in California now. Did they actually pass that, or is it still in the works?
No, it's passed. There's still the religious exemption,
okay,
but there's no longer a personal exemption. New York has eliminated all exemptions.
Wow.
And there was certainly quite a fight in California. It was not an easy vote.
Mm-hmm.
And California passing this is one of those examples of, they say, good facts make bad law. And the good facts in this situation were the measles outbreak started in Disneyland. So it really brought the issue to fore. And like, oh my God, Disneyland, the happiest place on earth, has a measles outbreak.
Mickey Mouse has measles.
And I mean, but that's what happens. That's how these things, you need a dramatic event.
It's all about fear, isn't it? It's driving some meme based on fear. But I'm going to ask you from a legal perspective. These vaccines aren't safe for everybody. They're not a one-size-fits-all. And for Gardasil, for example, they really never tested that vaccine to any long-length degree, right?
Right.
There are people who've died from it, people who've had neurological complications from it. It only, 4,000 people a year die of cervical cancer. So it's not a killer that it's over 50%. What happens if you're forced to take a vaccine and you have a bad outcome? What's the standing for the government to have made you do that? You've now had a dead child, somebody who may not be able to have children down the road. Does the benefit of making everybody do it outweigh the risk of it?
Well, it's interesting you say this and looking at it from a legal perspective. We'll get that out of the way first.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. That issue of mandatory vaccines was settled by the Supreme Court years ago. And the Supreme Court said that a parent cannot claim freedom from compulsory vaccination for the child more than for himself on religious grounds. And they said, you cannot use religious liberty to expose the community to communicable diseases. So they have decided that it's okay. So that's from the legal end. And then you march it over and say, all right, well, from the medical end or the human end, the liberty end, that this needs to be revisited. Because back in 1905, when the Supreme Court said that, and then there was another similar case in 1944, the medical knowledge that we have now was not available then.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like how some people discuss heaven, how we think of heaven as something that's above the ceiling. Well, when the concept was invented, people thought the earth was flat, so of course heaven would be above the ceiling. And now that people know the earth is round, people take a different view that it's sort of in the universe or whatever. And that's how you have to look at vaccines. When these decisions were made, people didn't know what we know now. So the idea that, well, you can't have your own decision because the community as a whole matters,
mm-hmm.
might have to be revisited, saying, well, perhaps more people are getting sick than not. And you can believe in vaccines, and it's a tough call, because certainly the one that scares me, frankly, the only one that scares me is German measles, because German measles will affect an unborn child.
Mm-hmm.
And if the woman who comes in contact with somebody with German measles is pregnant at the early stages, her child will bear the problems of being in contact with the child that had German measles. Beyond that, if your kid gets sick, your kid gets sick.
Mm-hmm.
And not that many children get measles encephalitis. Yes, there's gross side effects one can get from these childhood diseases. And some people now argue that the immunity isn't as good, then the whole immunity of the community isn't as good than if a few people get the disease, so you actually have good, strong antibodies out there that come from directly having the disease.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm no epidemiologist, so I'm certainly the wrong person on the details, but the concept of having more medical knowledge at our disposal to really look at the issue and not just go back and rely on a statement made in 1905, when we didn't know all these things about vaccines, I think is doing the community a disservice.
I agree.
It could be looked at again. Maybe they'll still come out with the same decision, but I think it needs to be looked at and not pass these laws in sort of a knee-jerk reaction. Because this whole thing just, boom, it was passed within months of the Disneyland outbreak.
Exactly. And I've done some reading on this, and especially about measles vaccine, and some of these other live killed, attenuated vaccines. When you get vaccinated, you actually shed the virus and you are infectious for a certain amount of time after you take a vaccine. I wonder how many pediatricians actually tell the patient's parents that that's a possibility. So when you look back at the Disneyland outbreak, there were a percentage of people who were there who had been vaccinated. You know, so they didn't tell you this on the news because it's driven by this mindset. And I follow the money always. The pharmaceutical industry, especially those who create vaccines, are embedded on Capitol Hill. They have a tremendous amount of influence on everything. They're coming out with an Ebola vaccine at some point. And I always question, when you get blanket immunity for what you've come out with, without having been tested, you just get it. And that's the reason why you create it. You can't be hurt. You can't go out of business. You don't have to pay a big fine. There's no downside to creating a vaccine anymore because you're immunized against anybody having a bad outcome. I question that. That means you can put anything you want out, call it a vaccine, mandate to the government, tell people they have to do it, and make a fortune. And then, by the way, oh, it's not safe years from now. What's the consequences of some of these vaccines? I'm not a big proponent of them for everything, right? I mean, if you're going out to Africa and you need to have shots for yellow fever, et cetera, fine. But getting childhood diseases probably isn't the worst thing you can get. You know, mumps, measles, chickenpox. Your immune system's better. And there's a study that I read, which was really fascinating, that if you get the mumps as a woman, there's a certain gene that turns on that may protect you against getting ovarian cancer, which was really
fascinating.
Isn't that fascinating? So maybe we should get some of these diseases to toughen our immune system so we can be more resilient. I've seen soldiers come back. I take care of them twice a week who, before they deployed, they were fine. They got their million immunization protocol and they came back with, you name it, multiple sclerosis, diabetes, all sorts of autoimmune diseases. And it just made me open my eyes to what the only thing that happened to them is they got a ton of shots. They were fine. What else were they exposed to? And not everybody reacts the same way. And I think that comes down to what you said at the beginning of the show. You can't expect everybody to react the same way to a medication. There's sex differences, there's race differences, there's age differences, and they're trying a one-size-fits-all method, which really, that's not medicine. That's just, I don't know what you want to call that, but it's potential to hurt a group of folks, and we won't know until it's already done. I'll be saddened if that happens under this protocol.
It makes it easy when you do one size fits all. We all know that.
Yeah.
It's certainly much easier to do it, and most people won't complain because they won't know the difference. And that brings us full circle to what we were talking about before the show, this idea of needing politicians to just blurt out the truth, because unless you are aware of the things that are going on, you'll just gladly accept it. Oh, well, that's how it is. Oh, well, such and such happened, but it can't be helped. And once you know some more facts, you realize some things can be helped. Oh, it could have been avoided. Oh, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do whatever it is that they've told us we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that many reasons for doing things are just made up. And we believe it.
I know. But, we should pay more attention, though.
Make something up. And it's kind of funny because it reminds me of some silly things parents will tell kids when they're kind of too young to get the full explanation. And sometimes I feel that that's exactly how the government is treating. President Obama always says that when he would say, oh, the reasons are nuanced. In other words, you're too dumb for me to tell you the real reason we're doing something. Well, guess what? We aren't that dumb.
Exactly.
We've just been lulled into complacency. And that's where it becomes up to us to wake our own selves up, because nobody else is going to.
Oh, that's exactly right. Personal responsibility. I'm tired of somebody thinking for me. Well, I never did it anyway, but I'm as you can tell.
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, you're right. I'm right. That was totally a foreign statement. But I'm tired of watching people having someone think for them. You know, my job as a doctor and a human being is to be an individual and to treat people as I would want to be treated. I don't want someone to come and tell me, this is how you do it. You should think this way. We know it's, that just makes me cringe. And especially when it's not helping people, it's hurting people. People are on this treadmill of, you see people every day. No one's really happy. They don't know why they're not really happy. Things aren't going well, but they're not really sure what to do about it. And I guess you have to be pushed to a point where you just can't take it anymore. And I'm hoping that this political season, the Donald Trump phenomenon, will help people jog them, you know, shake them into saying, you know, I may not like him, but I don't like what's going on here either. So let me start paying more attention and give people my opinion about, don't tell me what I'm supposed to think. I'm going to tell you what I think. An interesting thing about Congress, because I know you've been there, you know, to give opinion for AAPS and just, you know, you understand the legislative process. Would that work if we finally wake up and say, we're not voting for you, we're tired of business as usual, what do you do? When we start watching them under a microscope, will that change their behavior, or is money so powerful that they could care less and they feel totally protected that whatever we do, it won't matter?
Well, I hate to say, it seems like unless we're the one with the big money, they don't care. Look at what happened in the last election where many, many people were thrown out, and it was really quite historic. Mm-hmm. Normally, 94% of the time, incumbents win, and that didn't happen last time. Some people were actually thrown out, and people promised they were going to do this and they were going to do that. And perhaps they went to Congress and proposed some sort of legislation. But most proposed legislation just sits there and dies in committee. So if you're a person that really does what your constituents elected you to do, and you really are trying to follow their will, and they say they don't want X, so you write a bill that prohibits X, and then it just sits there in the committee and dies and never goes anywhere. So there you are, a voice. You tried to do right by your constituents, but then you just end up being a useless appendage in Congress. Right. So then the learning curve comes, and the congressperson says, well, gee, if I want to re-propose this bill, I'd better make friends with Joe and Pete. And then it turns out Joe and Pete aren't exactly the most savory characters, but it's okay because they'll help me get my bill out of committee. And that's part of that sausage making, and it's hard to know if there is, in fact, a way around it. The system started off okay. The idea that you have representatives, and these representatives were from the local areas, and they all get together and try to hash things out and pull together a law. But this idea that you have someone else pulling the strings, in medical case, the major pharmaceutical companies, and there's no question, I mean, this isn't speculation on our part. It's clear that they were the ones who were behind the ACA and whatnot, that it's hard to know how you break that stranglehold and say, no, it's what the people want that matters, not what the pharmaceutical company wants.
You know, that's the tragedy of losing the right for making everything mandated. It just disempowers people more. I mean, I think you should have personal choice. And if there really is a herd for vaccines, for example, if there is really a herd immunity, why does 100% of the people need to be immunized? You only need a portion to get the protection, technically. But
right.
I mean,
right.
The fact that we can't put pressure on the system that way by saying any parent, any adult who decides, you know what, I don't want to do this. I have a religious, a personal, an ethical, you know, rejection of this, and it's valid, then you can't put pressure on the system because the system is going to railroad you. It's all, you know, I have a real... It just turns me off. I can't even tell you how much for somebody who doesn't care about me. They don't care whether you get measles or mumps or not. They could care less whether you have a reaction to their meds. They just want to sell them. And that's my problem. If it really were paternalistic in the classic sense, where someone really did care about your best interest, they really did want you to be healthy, happy, free, then maybe we would have a different discussion. But it's never like that. It's always, you do it my way. If you don't conform, I will make you conform via regulation, compliance. And it's always bad. It doesn't work for Medicare. Doesn't work for patients. I mean, Obamacare is, it's a regulation bonanza. And I'm seeing patients every day that now are telling me, which I knew they would, I hate this. I can't afford to even, you know, have a procedure done. I've been denied for something that's medically necessary based on what the board, the American Academy of Otolaryngology says is an appropriate use of a procedure. Some insurance company just blows it out of the water and says, no, it's experimental. They're calling pulmonary function studies experimental here in Georgia. Can you believe that?
No, that's ridiculous.
Isn't it? Allergy testing is experimental. This is how they're getting around the system. Yeah, they're covering you for mammograms and, you know, routine care and vaccinations. But when you really need medical care, they're coming out of the crack with all sorts of bizarre, you know, just idiosyncratic decisions where you have no choice. And I know I want to get your take now on the amalgamation of all of these insurance companies. I thought it was a Trojan horse, the whole Obamacare thing. And after the passage of this last round through the Supreme Court, did you notice that they're all starting to join up and link up and become too big to fail?
Oh, well, it's now down to three if they allow the latest merger to go through. And it's interesting you say that. When the Obamacare thing came up, a lot of people who were looking at it from all sorts of angles said, this, even though it looks like, oh boy, you'll get insurance from a private insurer, it was very clear that that was step one. First, you have insurance from the private insurer. Then the private insurers merge to where they're practically single payer. There's so few that they might as well be single payer. And then because, oh my goodness, everybody's paying the same rate anyway, the government might as well do it.
Trojan horse. So who was the most recent merger? I know Anthem bought Cigna, which was tragic in my opinion. What else is going on? Is there something else?
That was the latest. I think a lot of people don't realize on these mergers that some companies are already merged. They just keep their own name.
That's true.
And so you don't realize that it actually is another company. You know, it's kind of like the same people that own Jack in a Box, you know, own Taco Bell or something like this, you know, even though they have different names, that they're actually all the same people. And I don't have the notes on that offhand as far as the three main companies, unfortunately, that, but
I think I know. I think it's Aetna, Blue Cross.
Aetna, United Health.
Yeah, and Blue Cross now.
Yes. No, but Blue Cross is under someone else.
Really? So Anthem is separate from Blue Cross, I guess, then? Oh, man, this is a mess.
I'm trying to grab it. Okay. Aetna and Humana will be together.
Right.
And then
And Coventry, that's now part of that system, too.
And then you have Anthem taking Cigna, and then United Healthcare.
Everything else.
Has everything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, so no matter what the program is called, it, you know, it doesn't matter. And each company, you know, it has dominant markets in various parts of the country.
Correct.
So some people, like we used to have Cigna, and then Cigna kind of drifted away, and Cigna, there's more of it in the South and the East and all this type of thing. So again, people tend not to notice because they might not even have that company in their area. But yeah, and so your insurance might have a different name, but it's still just those companies.
It's a monopoly, basically, and antitrust laws don't apply to these guys either.
No, and besides, it still ends up being up to the government unless mm-hmm. somebody else sues, because the antitrust division and the Department of Justice are the ones that actually have to approve these mergers. Mm-hmm. So all they have to do is just approve it. If the big boy says, we want you to approve this one, they'll approve it. And so unless somebody sues, mm-hmm. then it's going to stay however it's approved. And who's going to sue?
Nobody.
Because if they're all colluding, because what would happen, even if you have single payer, it's just like Medicare, you still have private companies who do the administration.
Exactly.
The program.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a lot of people don't realize that Medicare, you're not getting the bill from some office in Washington. They have these third-party administrators that are the ones sending you out your bills and doing all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the insurance companies are already gathering the materials for them to be the third-party administrator.
Oh, I absolutely believe that. I think you're right on. You hit the nail on the head. And they're skimming their little administrative fee off the top while they deny the care down the road. So they're getting a double dip. You know, the government's going to pay them to administer it. They're going to collect a premium. They're going to decide what's medically necessary and deny, deny, deny. And here we are, doctors getting, and this is my favorite line from the merger from Anthem and Cigna in Atlanta, in the Georgia area. Now this gives us, quote, leverage against the doctors or the providers. Yeah, you know what leverage means? It means less reimbursement, more administrative hurdles, more paperwork, more pre-certifications. That's what that means by leverage.
Oh, it's crazy. And even the idea that that's even part of the equation.
Yeah.
It would be nice if you heard somebody say, oh, this will be able to have a more streamlined system of approving patients or whatever. No, that's not the reason.
Not at all.
And it's scary. And this is where we kind of come to the idea of somehow letting patients know that you have to be plugged in to somebody who can deliver care free of the third-party influence, because sometimes that could end up being the only place where you're going to try to get the care that you really need and get an opinion that's the physician's opinion, not the opinion of the tool behind the telephone at the insurance company.
I couldn't have said it better. We have a couple of minutes left. I know I'm going to throw a bomb at you because I know it's not an easy answer, and I know you're going to have to come back to answer this probably, but everybody's on the bandwagon of the health savings accounts on the Republican side and people who want to reform against Obamacare as if that's the best thing since sliced bread. What's your take on health savings account, HSAs?
I think they're a wonderful idea,
mm-hmm.
but they're not the complete answer. How's that for a hedging answer? The idea that people save some money to spend on health, and yes, it's kind of okay if you put it here, we're going to make you save it,
mm-hmm.
but people do tend not to be able to save on their own, and it's a good idea to have some sort of segregated account.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with having this tax-sanctioned account, again, it puts government control over the money and
exactly.
what you use it for. And that's the downside. But I have to look at HSAs like nothing's perfect. And the concept of having people save their own money to spend on their own health, to me, is a step forward to the idea that you should be taking care of this yourself and have health insurance be just like home insurance. For you have it for big things,
mm-hmm.
really big things, like paying for ICU visits and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
but not for your everyday care, and get you more in the mindset that paying for everyday care is like putting gas in your car.
I absolutely agree with that. The only thing I would say to add to that would be it has to be uncoupled from government regulation in the sense that they tell you what you can pay for, and it should never be administered by the insurance companies because it comes under the same, under the same umbrella of them deciding whether it's medically necessary, whether it's experimental. You're now having your own money turned against you when they get to decide. Now, I know we have a seconds left, but please tell us how we can reach you.
AAPSonline.org.
Awesome. You know,
and it's a great website to check out and check out as a physician how to opt out of Medicare and as patients to find doctors who are third-party free and will kind of make deals with you as far as giving you medical care, the kind that you need, not the kind the government tells you you need.
And I'm a member of AAPS as well, so I believe me, Dr. Singleton speaks the truth. I can't wait to have you back on. Thank you so much for getting up at the crack of dawn to be with us.
Oh, anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.